well prepared right now to go wait until you're off your A game and think that you're going to be out of your thinking about.
So can you tell us what's on the test or what kind of problems you're going to test?
Well, so I think I've said lots of times before, I mean, calculating B by integration. That's a surefire thing. Ampere's law. Some sort of Ampere's law problem is, I think, a sure thing. And our favorite, Laplace. A sure thing. If you want to get scared, you can look at b3.pdf, which I assign for homework in the future. So that actually consists of problems that I almost put on the exam. I worked so hard to develop those problems that I couldn't throw them away, so I just assigned them as homework. I think that there's a webcast with, is that not true?
There is.
Okay.
So if you think it's going to be that similar, I think it was last time. I would say it was pretty similar, like there was a similar problem.
Similar type, but different.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, I told you, so these three problems I think occur on that exam.
Okay.
I think there might be a Gauss's law problem with, in the old T2 that was, you know, for dielectrics, and that was on our exam one, so there won't be a problem like that. So I think the other problem it had was one like we had in our B2, which was where you were finding A fields, etc. You were finding B fields from A fields and things like that. So that, I ain't saying that that's on the exam, but I'm saying that that's what was on the old exam. So we just got two little unknowns, something to surprise you, pleasantly or unpleasantly, on Thursday, on Wednesday. And it's the usual story, right? You can have a cheat sheet, one-sided. You can bring your little book that has the curl, etc. in it.
Crumley gave us a version that was 4 years older than
yours. That just shows where Crumley is, just not up to date. Well, he must have got a lot of them at once. I order them every year. And I bet you can't find a difference between those two.
Look at the color.
Did you complain to Crumley?
Oh, yeah, I said something.
What did Crumley say?
Crumley said, not much has changed.
But he didn't defend himself for giving the old
one.
That's too bad. We could have had a Crumley war. So, forces and torques, if we look at the electric field, I think things look pretty simple, right? The forces in the direction of the electric field. We have lots of different ways we could write the little bit of charge and add up those charges. We've got dipoles where we have charge separation, and we showed all of these relationships. Things are substantially more complicated for the magnetic field, where we've got a cross product that's going to mess things up. And of course, the little bit of current could come as a wire, it could come as a surface current, it could come as something that's flowing through a solid. But in fact, what we showed is that these same sort of things are exactly true with magnetic fields. So, you know, kind of importantly, just as an electric dipole, there is no net force in a uniform electric field. For a magnetic dipole, there's no net force. There is a torque. And if the magnetic field isn't uniform, then there will be a force that we could calculate. So typically what happens for either of these cases, if we have a dipole in a non-uniform field, the first thing it does is it rotates until the torque is zero, until the dipole is pointing in the direction of the field. And then it can go downhill by going to larger and larger fields. So we have, you know, static cling being attracted to positive charge and static cling being attracted to negative charge. And analogously, we have a nail being attracted to a north pole or a nail being attracted to a south pole. And along the way, we took a look at these loop integrals where we have, say, the integral of x dy, which maybe looks a little bit funny. And what we said is those things are going to be zero if we choose the same coordinate. Otherwise, they're going to be plus or minus the area. And I don't know, that kind of reminds you of this Leibovitz symbol, which is also zero if any of these things are repeated, and it's going to be either plus or minus one. So the way we decided to go around proving things, I don't know, could go under the name of index manipulation. And instead of having things like backcab where we have vectors, we write the equivalent thing in terms of things with lots of indices. And the idea is that it's actually easier to manipulate these indices than it is to manipulate these vectors in complicated situations. Along the way, we introduced Einstein summation notation, where we don't bother to write the sum over things because anytime an index is repeated, it's going to be summed over. So why bother to write the sigma? It's easier not to. So in this equation, for example, the j's are being summed 1, 2, 3, and the k's are being summed 1, 2, 3. And most of those terms are going to be 0 because anytime j equals I or k, the result is 0. So the only terms, the only out of those 3 times 3 terms, the only ones that are actually going to count are when we have 1, 2, 3 and when we have 1, 3, 2. And those are exactly going to produce the minus sign that we need for the cross product in the x direction. Okay, so we add lots of unnecessary terms, but it's easier to manipulate these things once they're in some form. And for those who want to learn more, you can try and do a Google search on rotationally invariant tensors, because that's what the epsilon and the delta are. Kind of the rotationally invariant tensors. Might remind you that magnetic dipole is defined with a right-hand rule. Twist your fingers around the current, and then your thumb's going to point in the direction of the magnetic dipole moment. Questions? Well, how lucky could we be? Right. So if we, so far, we seem to be extraordinarily lucky. We've been able to write things that look pretty much exactly for electric fields the way they look for magnetic fields, even though there really isn't a real close connection between the two. Right. So, you know, for example, the divergence of the magnetic field is zero, whereas the divergence of the electric field is given by the charge density. And the curl of the electric field is zero, but the curl of the magnetic field is given by wires. So, tremendous differences, but in the end, we're able to make things look the same. What came next in the electric fields is we realized that material was made out of stuff that was polarizable. So if we have a piece of glass in an electric field, there'd be zillions of little dipoles from all of those little molecules, and they would add up to change what the electric field was. And in the end, we seemed to be pretty lucky. We could rewrite lots of equations that didn't seem to care about the presence of the dielectric. So the D field, for example, it only cared about the free charges, not all of the bound charges. So are we going to be that lucky when we deal with magnetic material? Will we be able to rewrite our equations so that they look more or less the same, except maybe we have some new notations? Right? So kind of reminding you, the deal was we were able to write the D field as epsilon naught E plus P, and this P was add up all of the little dipoles that are in some volume. It was the net electric dipole moment per unit volume, and things pretty much go swimmingly with D. D only cares about the free charge, and in particular, the divergence of D was just equal to the free charge density. So if we try and play the same game with magnetized material, so just as glass is made out of stuff that is polarizable, some material is made out of stuff that when you put it in a magnetic field, it produces magnetic dipole moments, right? So here we had dipoles, little individual atomic dipoles that were produced, and they were proportional to the applied electric field. How about in a similar situation? If we have material and we put a magnetic field on it, do we get that material producing lots of magnetic dipole moments? And I don't know, the answer I would say pretty much has to be yes, right? Because just as atoms are made out of plus and minus stuff that can be charged, atoms are also made out of currents, and those currents can be aligned with the magnetic field or not aligned with the magnetic field. So there ought to be magnetization when we apply magnetic fields. It turns out that it's trickier than you might expect. And in the sense that, first of all, mostly this is small change. Usually you can neglect this. The cases where you can't neglect it, and as a result, you know, most things aren't attracted to a magnet, right? A piece of wood is not attracted to a magnet, even though wood is made out of stuff that has magnetic dipole moments associated with it. Most commonly, there's actually a reverse relationship, so that the magnetic dipole you get is in the minus B direction, not in the plus B direction. It's small, so it's usually negligible, but usually it's in the opposite direction as the magnetic field. So this is called diamagnetic materials. Now you remember that something like water was made out of things that had dipole moments, and those things could be oriented if the temperature wasn't too strong, causing thermal disruption. And the same sort of thing applies to some magnetic materials. They intrinsically have magnetic dipole moments, and they can be oriented if the temperature isn't too warm to disrupt them. Those things are called paramagnetic materials. And probably the most common example of that is liquid oxygen. But the things that are attracted to magnets, nails and things like that, they have a lot of very special properties, and they're called ferromagnets. The ferro is, of course, referring to iron, and iron isn't the only stuff that has this property, but I don't know, only a handful of elements on the periodic table are ferromagnetic. Okay, so we'll want to talk about these things eventually, but you remember that we were able to argue that for pretty good reasons, we expect the thing that is the dielectric constant to be, you know, 1, 2, 3 for normal sorts of materials, because it was the fraction of volume that was atom divided by the fraction of total volume. And we saw extraordinary cases like water where this dielectric constant was 80. And what we'll find, kind of no surprise, is the equivalent thing over here in the magnetic world is typically going to be, you know, lots of zeros before you hit something, even for solids, right? So the dielectric constant for air was 1 because mostly air is vacuum. But even for solids, we're going to find that that thing is small, with the exception. Say again? Yeah, so I think maybe our book is going to put K sub m's in there or something, but we're pretty far away from that level of detail. I'm just trying to give you kind of an overview. For these ferromagnetic materials, very commonly K is 1,000, and not tremendously uncommonly, it might be 1,000,000. So for ferromagnetic materials, they're way more dipole-ish than solids are. On the other hand, typical materials are way less. So there's a huge dichotomy in the magnetic world between normal stuff and the stuff that is attracted to magnets. Okay, so it's pretty much a pretty straightforward process, just analogous to what we did for the other one. So you might remember that we said that for the voltage for a point dipole, it was the magnetic dipole dotted into r minus r prime divided by r minus r prime cubed, and then with the 4 pi epsilon naught stuff. And what we did is we said that in a little bit of volume, the amount of dipole would be just be the polarization, capital P times dV. And so we just added up this effect. And we were able to show through a bunch of manipulations that this thing was equivalent to a bound charge density that was minus the divergence of the polarization and a surface charge density that was P dot N. And the hope, and of course the only reason I mention it, is that we're going to get similar sorts of, similar but more complicated relationships for magnetization. So if we start pretty much analogously to how we started with electric fields, we don't have a voltage, well, we do have a scalar potential for magnetization, but it's not general. It would require there to be no free currents. So the only thing we have for proving things usually is the A vector, which while it's a mess to usually calculate, is great for proving things. And what we showed is that the A vector for a point dipole was the magnetic dipole moment crossed into r minus r prime divided by the magnitude of r minus r prime cubed. Not too surprising, right? Instead of a dot, we've got a cross, but otherwise it's pretty similar. And of course, we needed to get a vector out of this because this was the vector potential. So kind of no surprise, we're going to say that in a little bit of volume, there's going to be a net magnetic dipole moment that is just MdV. So this is a capital M. So the net vector potential that we're going to get from all of this is going to be mu naught over 4 pi add up over the material, the magnetization dV crossed into r minus r prime divided by r minus r prime cubed. Okay, so now the fun begins, the sort of vector manipulation in order to try and get this into standard form. And of course, the standard form is mu naught divided by 4 pi and then the current divided by r minus r prime. So if we can get this thing into that form, we can read off what the equivalent current is, the equivalent of a bound charge density, except this is going to be a bound current. And the starting point, as usual, is this little thing here, which should remind you a whole lot about electric fields. Right? So we know, that, I hope you remember, that that's minus the gradient of 1 over r minus r prime, 1 over the gradient of the voltage in order to get that radially outward electric field. And as usual, we can substitute minus gradient for plus gradient prime, basically because the difference between taking the extra derivative of the inside is going to generate an extra minus sign. So if we use that, what we've got then is mu naught over 4 pi, the magnetization at some source point, I'll write my dV at the far end, crossed into the gradient with respect to the primed coordinates of 1 over r minus r prime. And now we can use one of those identities that are in the book, the curl of a scalar function times a vector is pretty much what you would expect. It's that scalar function times the curl of f. And this minus sign might throw you for a loop a little bit. It's f crossed into the gradient of phi. And this minus sign is basically to turn that order around. So what we've got, of course, is a term like this. So if we rewrite that guy, what we're going to get is mu naught over 4 pi the integral of 1 over r minus r prime. That's playing the role of phi, right? And then we're going to get that times the curl of m. and we're going to get minus, so I'm bringing this term over to that side, minus the integral of the curl of the magnetization divided by magnitude of r minus r prime. Okay, so I guess all I'm going to do is rewrite that first term because it's done. So we've got mu naught over 4 pi integrate up the curl cross the magnetism, and this is really the curl prime if I do it right. The curl with respect to its coordinates divided by r minus r prime dv. And if we compare that to the generic form, what we learn is that there is a current density, I'll call it a bound current density, that is the curl of m. Well, what are we going to do with the other term? So if you look at kind of the tricky identities, this is not one that we proved, and proving these things is a little bit of a hassle, but where can I put it? Well, we'll try and fit it in. Yes, we'll try and fit it in here. So if you look at those chapter one identities, what we have is, what we've got is the volume integral of the curl of F is equal to the surface integral of N cross F. Okay, so it's a little bit like Gauss's law in the sense that a derivative in a volume integral is disappearing to give us an area integral. But it's not exactly Gauss's theorem, because Gauss's theorem, of course, wanted this to be the divergence. Okay, so this was in chapter one, a list of identities. And it's not, it is a consequence of the things that we've proved, but it's not exactly an obvious consequence of it. Okay, so if I rewrite that last term in that way, what I'm going to get is, yeah, okay, I am going to use that minus sign to turn it around. So what I'm going to get is mu naught over 4 pi, the integral of this bound current density, and now plus the integral of F, which is the magnetization over r minus r prime, that crossed into n dA. So I use this minus sign to turn those two guys around. Okay, so this is exactly like a surface current. The book likes lowercase j's for those surface currents, but I think I'm going to go with k. Okay, so what this says is that if we have a problem where we know what the magnetization is inside of an object, instead of going through this process of calculating the A field, we can instead deal with the equivalent currents, a volume current that is the curl of M and a surface current that is M cross N. Okay, just exactly analogously to what we did with electric fields, where if we knew what the polarization was, we could go through and calculate things for that polarization, but typically what we did is said that that was equivalent to a volume charge density that was minus the divergence of P and a surface charge density that was P dot N. Okay, so to give a particular example for electric fields, if we had a uniformly polarized object, obviously the divergence of P is going to be zero, so there's no volume charge density, but there is going to be P dot N, right? So there's going to be the equivalent of a surface charge density on the top and a negative surface charge density on the bottom. and then we could just go and calculate what the electric field would be from those charge distributions, right? And that would be some sort of dipole, kind of like that. Okay? Vaguely memorable? Some people have bigger nods than others. Okay, so what if we do the same thing with a magnetized object? So let's imagine something that has lots of magnetic dipole moments that all happen to be aligned. Something like this is a permanent magnet. What is going to be the equivalent distribution of current? Well, because it's constant, the curl of M is going to be zero, so there's no volume currents flowing. On the other hand, at every surface, here's the normal. So if we take M cross N, it's going to be a current that's going into the page here. And if we look at N on this side, it's going to be a current that's coming out of the page. So what we have is a current that's going around this magnetized object. Because N is the out, N is the outward going normal, right? Are we okay? You wouldn't choose a normal that switches direction halfway through, right? So if you have a normal that's here on this side, it better be outward on that side. And of course, M cross N hat is going to be zero on these top and bottom surfaces, right? Because if you have two vectors that are in the same direction and you cross them, you get zero. So a bar magnet is equivalent to a solenoid. Right, a solenoid is where we have current that's going around the outside. And if you want to kind of think about this macroscopically, if I look down on this magnetized piece of material, what I've got, of course, is zillions of little atoms that have magnetic dipoles that are going around like that. And you can see what's going to happen. We're going to get, so for this, let me kind of blow up these two guys here. If I blow up those two guys, I had the outer one that was going like this and the inner one that was going the same way, but that means that at this spot, they're canceling currents. So the result of having all of these dipoles is the only place that we don't have canceling current is on the outer edge. And so it's equivalent to a surface current that's going around the edge. If the magnetization is actually changing inside of this object, then these magnetic dipoles won't be exactly the same and they won't exactly cancel. So then there would be a volume current that would be related to the curl of M. Okay, so instead of dealing with actually doing those integrals when we have some sort of magnetization that depends on position, we can calculate the equivalent currents, and then we can use all of the tools that we have for calculating fields from currents in order to figure out what the corresponding magnetic field is. And for example, we know what the magnetic field is for the solenoid. The magnetic field is going to be going around like that, and on the inside of this solenoid, the magnetic field is going to be mu naught times K, where K is the surface current, right? Exactly that. So inside this bar magnet, we expect that the magnetic field is going to be B times M. And outside, it's going to be relatively small. The further we get away from the permanent magnet, the smaller it's going to be. Okay. So when we're dealing with electric fields, we found that there was a volume charge density that was minus the divergence of P. And that meant that when we looked at the divergence of the electric field, we know that that's 1 over epsilon naught times the total charge density, which was the free charge density plus the bound charge density. And we rearrange this equation, bring the epsilon over to the other side. So we had divergence of epsilon naught E is equal to the free charge density minus the divergence of P. And then we brought the divergence of P over. We had epsilon naught E plus P is equal to the free charge density. And this quantity here we called the auxiliary field D. And everything was simpler when we were dealing with D as opposed to E. D only paid attention to the free charge, and typically we know where the free charges are, so we were good. So can we play that same game with magnetic fields? Can we make things look simple? And obviously we wouldn't be saying that unless it was true. So what we have for magnetic fields is that the curl of B is equal to mu naught times the total current. And the total current is going to be made up out of the free current, the current that, actually, it's good to switch colors. How does this one work? Oh, it's good. So the free current, the total current is going to be a combination of the free current and the magnetization current. And we've just said that the magnetization current was the curl of M. So this equation is going to work a little bit different from how it did with the electric field, as you'll see in a minute. So here we've got the mu up top as opposed to below. So what we're going to have then is the curl of 1 over mu naught B is equal to the free current, the current that we know about, plus these atomic currents that are making up the material. And if I rearrange this, I've got the curl of 1 over mu naught B minus M is equal to the free current. So this is the simple equation, so quite naturally we're going to call this the auxiliary field H. Well, so let's take this in a couple of different directions. So when we were talking about electric fields, what we said is that the polarization, what I said at least, was the polarization was epsilon naught times the susceptibility times the electric field. That is to say, I connected the effect with E. And what we're going to do with magnetic fields is a little bit reversed, and you'll see that the algebra works out. What we're going to say here is that the magnetization is equal to chi times H. Right, so here we connected things to the real field, and here we connected things to this auxiliary field. So if we go with that, what we've got then is 1 over mu naught B minus M is equal to H. And now let's plug and chug that our M is equal to chi H. So we have 1 over mu naught B is equal to 1 plus chi H. And B is equal to mu naught times 1 plus chi times H. Okay, so in the electric field world, what we had was was that the auxiliary field was equal to epsilon naught 1 plus chi times E. And here we have kind of the reverse. The real field is given as a multiple of the auxiliary field. You know, similar but different. And, you know, quite naturally, we're going to call this quantity mu, and I'm going to call the magnetic dielectric constant K as 1 plus chi. So very similar relationships are going to hold between the electric world and the magnetic world, except we have this kind of funny inversion as to here it's the real thing is giving us the auxiliary thing, and here the auxiliary thing is giving us the real thing. But
D equals epsilon naught times quantity 1 plus?
1 plus chi. times the electric field. Right? So that's all just old stuff from chapters in the past. Okay, so now I can be more explicit. When I was saying that there were big or small electric magnetic effects, I was talking about this K. Whether K for most materials is, you know, 1 plus or minus 1,000th, well, actually a 10,000th would be kind of typical for materials, or whether this K might be 100,000 for so-called ferromagnetic materials. So one particularly important circumstance for magnetic fields is the existence of permanent magnets, which are objects that have some built-in magnetization, and you don't have to connect them to a power supply. So there are no free currents. If we look at the equations for no free currents, that means that the curl of H is going to be zero. And if the curl of something is zero, then we can write it as minus the gradient of something, where this is another version of a magnetic scalar potential. Now, in analogy to an electric field, if we know what the divergence of H is, we can calculate what this potential is, right? Because the equivalent things for the electric field are that the curl of E is equal to zero, and the divergence of E is equal to the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And from that, we could immediately write down that the voltage was 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the charge density divided by R minus R prime dV. So if I know what the divergence of H is, I can immediately write down a formula for what the equivalent of voltage is for the H field. It doesn't have a name as far as I know. And it's pretty easy to do because this is the formula for H. So the divergence of H is the divergence of 1 over mu naught B minus M. Alex, did you have a question? And we know that the divergence of B is equal to zero, no magnetic monopoles. So the divergence of H is just minus the divergence of M. And in analogy to electric charge, we're going to call this the pole density. And it means we can immediately write down, without any ado, what the formula is for that scalar potential. It's exactly analogous to voltage. So the, and we'll stick with red. So the we have that H is minus the gradient of phi, and phi is going to be 1 over 4 pi, there's no mu here, so then we're going to have the integral of this pole density divided by R minus R prime. And this pole density is just minus the divergence of M. Now, I've been a little bit cavalier. In addition to these volume pole densities, there can be surface pole densities. And we want to get those in the picture too. Those are just going to be m dot n. So this is surface pole charge, like sigma.
That would be what you would put in for m, dot n.
So just as we could put in rho dV or sigma dA, we can put in, if we have distributed pole charge, we can put in minus the divergence of m dV, or we can put in m dot n dA. So let's go back to the kind of simple model we have of a permanent magnet, which is a bar in which we have a uniform magnetization. And we've said that that's equivalent to a solenoid, where we have surface currents flowing. But if we adopt this point of view about poles, we can also say what's going on. So because it's uniform, the divergence of M is going to be zero every place. So there isn't going to be any charge density inside this object. But M dot N is going to be positive on this end, and it's going to be negative on this end. So the H field is going to be just like the electric field was for the polarized object, right? The electric field, the H field in this case, is going to be going down like that, and it's going to be going around like this. Okay. Because if you had just, so this is exactly analogous to electrical charge, and we've got positive charge here, negative charge there, so this is exactly what you would expect for an electric field, right? Now outside here, H is equal to 1 over mu naught B because M is equal to 0 out there, so H and B have exactly the same form on the outside. What's going on the inside? Well, you might remember we showed a second ago, to the extent that we could consider this an infinite solenoid, the magnetic field inside of a solenoid was given by mu naught times the surface current, and we said that the surface current in this case was just equal to M. So we're going to get for our H field inside of this thing is going to be H is equal to 1 over mu naught B minus M, and it's approximately going to be equal to 0. And I don't know, that should maybe bother you a little bit, but remember that the formula we've derived is for an infinite solenoid. And if we have an infinite solenoid, even if we have these plus charges and minus charges, they're going to be very far away, infinitely far away, in the limit of the infinite solenoid, and so as a result, the H field is going to be zero on the inside. If we make this solenoid smaller, then the magnetic field is going to be a little bit less than what's given by the infinite solenoid formula, and so now the magnetic field is going to be in the negative direction, small and negative like that. Okay. Well, you don't usually make permanent magnets like this, but it's good to think about it. How about if we have a penny of magnetized material? What's going to be the situation then? Well, so this is equivalent to a surface current that is flowing on the outside. Right. Remember, the surface current is given by M cross N. That surface current K, there isn't very much of it. So the total current that's flowing in this loop is just going to be K times the thickness, let me call it D, of this nickel. So we have a current that's flowing around the outside that has that effect. And it's complicated to calculate what the magnetic field is in general under these circumstances, but you know, roughly speaking, it's going to be looking like that, and we have calculated what the magnetic field is for a current loop on the z-axis, for example. And you might remember that the magnetic field at the center is given by mu naught I divided by 2R. So to the extent that D is very small, the magnetic field, the B field, inside of this loop is going to be small. Right? So this is going to be mu naught K d divided by 2r, and as d is going to 0, the magnetic field is going to be going to 0. Okay, so outside we have the solenoid field, inside the magnetic field is going to be relatively small. What does the H field say about all of this? Well, according to the H field, there is a positive pole density all over this top surface, and there's a negative pole density all over the negative surface. And this looks a whole lot like a parallel plate capacitor. For the parallel plate capacitor, the electric field on the inside was the charge density divided by epsilon naught. So what we're going to find here is that the magnetic field, the H field on the inside, no epsilon naughts in our formula, is just equal to the magnetization. Oops. So the electric field was going down, so it's going to be going like that. H is going to be minus M. And if H is minus M, then the B field has to be 0, right? Because this is H plus M is proportional to B. Okay, so these are all crude-ish approximations for what these fields would look like under various circumstances. Well, one thing that's maybe useful to check for polarized material, it's made out of dipoles, so if we add up all of the charge, we got to get zero, right? Because it's made out of things that just have charge separation. And we know that there aren't actually magnetic monopoles, so it better be that if I add up all of this fictitious pole charge, I'll get zero. Right, so here's my object. I don't mean to make it particularly symmetric. It's got poles on the inside that are minus the divergence of M, and it's got poles on the outside that are M dot N. And we're claiming that just as with the dielectric, it all has to cancel. There has to be no net poles from this piece of magnetized material. Okay, so let's just add it up. So for the volume, we want to add up the pole charge density, which is minus the divergence of M. And for the surfaces, we want to add up the M dot N dA. We can use Gauss's law to convert this volume integral into the surface integral. And those two guys exactly cancel. So there are no magnetic monopoles inside our magnetized object, no matter how it's magnetized. And as I say, exactly analogous results we showed for the bound charge of a polarized dielectric. It was made out of plus and minus charges, so it had to all add up to zero in the end. So the other game we played was for electric fields, is we said that since the D field had a particularly symmetric form, we could make a Gauss's law where we integrate D dot N dA, and we would just get the enclosed free charge. Right? In contrast to the electric field, and it's going to give us the free plus the bound charge divided by epsilon naught. And often as not, we don't know what the bound charge is, so the electric field is more problematic to deal with in the presence of polarized materials. So how is that going to work for our magnetic fields? So what we've got is the nice equation that the curl of H just depends on the free charge densities, the currents that we see are flowing in wires, not these atomic currents that there's not much we can do about. If we think about, you know, any sort of surface that you might want to name, we can integrate the curl of H over that surface. And of course, because the curl of H is equal to the free charge density, this is the free current. This is going to give us the current times the area, and that has to be the enclosed current. Right, so the current that actually pierces this surface, remember that current density is current per area, we're multiplying it by area and we're adding everything up. So this is going to give us the total enclosed, the total current that pierces that surface. On the other hand, the other side of this equation is that we can convert this into the loop integral around the boundary of that surface of H dot dl. So we've got then a new version of Ampere's law that if we take the loop integral of H dot dl, we get the actual enclosed, free, non-bound current that is flowing. Okay, so everything works out pretty analogously with magnetic fields as it did with electric fields. And the fly in the ointment is that for most materials, of course, chi is essentially equal to zero, so there's no reason to bother with any of this. And for ferromagnetic materials, what I've said is that chi is huge. But the truth is that it's nonlinear. So there isn't a linear relationship between the magnetization and the applied H field. So that means we can only kind of somewhat crudely approximate the nonlinear relationship by the linear approximation to it. So what's going on with the magnetization versus H? Well, I think we've talked about this, touched on this before. So let's do the following experiment. Let's take our piece of iron and let's wrap some turns around it. And the H field, of course, is going to be proportional to the actual free current, the current that's flowing in those wires. When the H field turns on, we're going to get all of the atomic currents, the atomic current loops inside this piece of iron aligned, and we're going to get some equivalent of bound charge. And that's going to make a magnetization. And if we make a plot of the magnetization versus the H field, or equivalently the current that we're putting through this coil, what happens is that to start out, there is a pretty linear relationship between the magnetization and the current, but eventually the thing saturates when we get basically 100% of the atomic dipoles aligned with the H field. And then if we start to turn off the current, it doesn't retrace that path. It takes a different path back, right, which is hysteresis. As we start to reverse the current, eventually we can reverse the magnetization and we get saturation in the other direction. If I now turn the current to the positive direction, I can reduce that magnetization, but when the current is zero, there's still some magnetization in the reverse direction, and I can saturate it the other way. Okay, so there is a not only a nonlinear relationship between M and H or I, it also isn't really a function of one or the other. It depends on the history. So we've got hysteresis plus nonlinearity for real magnetic materials. And that's not great, but if we have a graph like this, we can often figure out what the magnetization is going to be. Right? So if I know that I took an unmagnetized piece of material and I subjected it to this H, I can just read off this graph what the corresponding magnetization is, as opposed to just using the nice linear equation that the magnetization is going to be chi times H. Right? Under those circumstances, I'm assuming that there's a nice line where there isn't such a line. Okay, so hysteresis, nonlinearity, but big effects. Those are the main events for ferromagnetic materials. The other sorts of materials, paramagnetic materials, diamagnetic materials, well, for large enough magnetic fields, paramagnetic materials would also have to saturate, but basically you'd have to have pretty extraordinary conditions to saturate typical paramagnets. Okay, questions? Well, I think we'll mostly call it quits then. Let me kind of comment what's in the future. Well, one of the things we want to deal with are magnetic circuits. So I'm not sure if you've seen that big old black magnet that is down in the demo room, but it has kind of a shape like that. It's got a permanent magnet and it's got these arms, and there's a piece of iron that's called a keeper that typically we're going to fill this gap with if we don't have a reason to have a magnetic field that's going through the air. And it turns out that there's an exact analogy between this sort of magnetic circuit where the magnetic field is going around in a circle and the corresponding electrical circuit where we have resistors and batteries. So the permanent magnet turns out is kind of like a battery, and all of this magnetic material is kind of like a resistor, and the air is like a big resistor, and by putting in that keeper, we're reducing the demagnetizing effect inside this piece of permanent magnet. So instead of resistors, we're going to have reluctance, and instead of currents, we're going to have flux, and there's basically kind of a one-to-one correspondence between these sorts of situations. Okay, so none of that's on the exam. Right? We quit on magnetic materials. We quit on magnetic fields in vacuum, and don't go on to the more complicated situations. Well, I got 10 minutes. So why don't I talk a little bit about diamagnetism? So remember, diamagnetism was kind of the strange situation where I apply a magnetic field and the magnetic dipole moment is in the opposite direction as the magnetic field. Why would that be the case? And the first story I want to say is, if anyone ever gives you a proof of diamagnetism, they're lying. Well, they're lying unless they're doing it in quantum mechanics. So one can show that in classical mechanics, diamagnetism is zero. There is no diamagnetism in the context of classical mechanics. It is a purely quantum mechanical effect. So I have to hide that somehow or other. And to give you the flavor of how this works in quantum mechanics. So we're talking about atoms. So first of all, why aren't magnetic dipole moments more common in atoms the way they are in glass or any other sort of material? And the answer is that very typically, electrons are in pairs that are making up a bond. So if we have an electron that's going around this way, it has a partner that's going around the other way. So there's no net magnetic dipole moment. So cases where you have unpaired electrons are pretty rare. Radicals are one example of where this occurs. The other common example, as I said, is liquid oxygen, where because of the molecular orbitals, it turns out you get two electrons that have their spins aligned as opposed to anti-aligned. So this is the usual situation, though, for most materials. The electrons are in kind of equal and opposite orbits. What happens if I apply a magnetic field that's out of the page? And I think for convenience, we might as well think about electrons as being positively charged, and you can change all the signs in a second if you want to, but it'll make, I think, our thinking a lot easier. So for this electron, what's the direction of the force on it? Yeah, it's going to be pointing like that, right? V cross B. And what we know, of course, is that the net force is going to be the centripetal force, that is omega squared r. So by reducing this force, omega is going to be reduced. In contrast, that the guy that's going around this way, it's going to feel a magnetic force that is towards the center. We good? So if I increase that centripetal force, then maybe I should have used a different color. So for this guy here, this force is inward, and the omega is going to have to be increased. So what's happened? So the current that's going around this way and is making a dipole moment that is out of the page has been reduced because the current is going slower. The magnetic dipole moment that's going around the other way is being increased. And so we're going to end up with a magnetic dipole moment that is into the page, right? Before they exactly canceled. This guy was making a magnetic field up. The inner guy was making a magnetic field was down. Adds up to zero. This guy slowed down. This guy speeded up. And the result was a magnetic field that was pointing down. Okay, so I don't know. It may seem like a nice proof. I had to have lied. I think it was Schrodinger's thesis. It was one of those famous old guy's theses that proved that in the context of classical mechanics, there is no diamagnetism. This argument had been around for more than a century before that. Okay, so that's diamagnetism. Paramagnetism is just like it was with the electrical case. If we have free dipoles, they love to point in the direction of the magnetic field, right? Because the potential energy is minus mu dot B. If the temperature is low enough, they will align with that magnetic dipole. If the temperature is too high, they'll have pretty random results. But the result of this is exactly as it was with the electric field. If the temperature is sufficiently low, if we apply a magnetic field, some fraction of them will be aligned with the magnetic field, and then we'll have a positive value for the relationship between the dipole and the magnetic field direction. And ferromagnetism is another purely quantum mechanical effect. Well, maybe I can fit in the word domains. So it turns out for ferromagnetism, the quantum mechanics insists that the low energy state has all of the magnetic dipoles aligned all of the time. But that can't be literally the low energy state, because if all of these guys are aligned, they're going to make a big magnetic field, and there's magnetic energy. So what the material does is it has regions where all of the magnetic dipole moments are aligned, but the neighboring region, they're pointing in a totally different direction. So on average, there's no magnetic dipole moment, but on the scale of micro, so typically it's different for different materials, but kind of a typical value for these domain sizes might be micrometers or 10 micrometers. So quantum mechanics actually forces alignment 100%, but lower energy state forces the disalignment regions called domains. And what's happening when these things get magnetized is we are actually doing a couple of things. One possibility is to, if the magnetic field is in this direction, one possibility is to grow this domain so that it eats part of the other domain. And the other possibility is to rotate this domain until it points in the direction of the magnetic field. And both of those things happen. But the result is we have kind of bigger objects that we're moving around and can get stuck, making this hysteresis possible. Okay, so now I've used up most of my time. Questions? I'm saving all your questions for Ardoff.